sealing up. Thoughts chase one another in her mind like starving rats. Temin, Brenton, Leia and her child, Solo, Jazz, everyone, anyone, I'm disappointing them. She remembers a game as a child, a handheld game where you played these adventures and you got to choose where to go next. Fight the monster or run from it. Go through the swamp or run through the forest. Choose a blaster or a sonic knife. Be a pilot or a pirate. And now she realizes life is just like that. Just a series of choices. Sometimes you make the right ones and you get the good ending to the adventure. Other times, you're eaten by a rancor in the dark. She never did those games right. Maybe she didn't do her life right either. Then, up through the darkness, a sound. No, a voice. The voice is distorted and mechanized. She knows that voice. It belongs to a B-1 battle droid. Her son's creation. A cobbled-together robot monstrosity that will protect her child to the point of its total obliteration. Just as she would. Just as she must right now. Because Temin's here, isn't he? She couldn't save Brenton, but she can save her son. She fights her way through the dark water of her own drowning mind. Nora swims up through that septic layer of regret and fear, and she wills some part of her, any part of her, to wake up, to move. Her hand twitches, and then the arm follows. Before she even knows what she's doing, she's catching the door of her cradle just before it closes on her. She forces her eyes open, an act that is far more epic than it should be, but she manages it just the same. Her other hand flies to her face, where it grabs the tube snaking its way toward her nostril and yanks it away. The ship's voice cuts through the air.
SOLGDA has identified a perilous course of action and asks that you refrain from further violence against Ashmead's Lock. Please lie down on the ground now with your hands at your sides. Thank you for your understanding.
Then she repeats it in a language Nora can't understand, nor does she care to try. All she can think is finding the processor matrix of this IPU and emptying her blaster into it. Nora struggles out of her chamber, pushing the door wider. One of the mirrored droids appears. Its arm is tipped with another needle, and it plunges it toward her. Nora skirts to the side, and the needle sticks into the cushion just behind her. Then she growls one word. No. And leaps. She tackles the droid. Unprepared, it scrambles to stay clinging to the pod, but it's off balance, and its arms catch only open air as the two of them fall. Nora winces, the air rushing up around her. She pivots so the droid is beneath her, and just in time, too, as it slams into the railing on one of the staircases. The droid's back snaps with a sound like a tree breaking in half, and next thing she knows, she and the shattered droid are tumbling down the steps, end over end over end, until they hit the bottom floor. The air blasts out of her lungs, leaving her gulping for breath. The droid beneath her hitches and twitches, its head bent at a 90-degree angle. Nora tries to stand. Pain lances through her side, and she collapses. She lies there on her back, clutching her middle. The world blooms around her in light and dull sounds. She hears her son yelling, and then blaster fire and booming slugs tear apart the air over her. A droid descends upon her, its whipcord arms slashing at the air, and it's suddenly knocked aside by Bones. Bones, whose one arm is gone and whose leg is bent at a funny angle. Bones, whose own side is cratered in, dented like a kicked can. The B-1 droid tries to say something, but the sound only comes out as a garbled scream. Above them all, SOLGDA narrates a constant warning for them to stop, lest they be destroyed. Next comes a flare of light, and a crackle of little lightning filling the air above her. Nora rests her head, and once more, all goes dark. And yet, she's awake. She didn't go dark. The ship did. The power has gone out. Temin grabs her hand.
I'm here, Mom. I'm here.
And with that, Ashmead's lock goes dead, and SOLGDA goes silent.
Interlude. The city of Binjai Tin, Nag Abdur.
The jagged campanile towers of the Abdurian homes lie shattered. Bodies lie underneath, crushed, shot, lanced, dozens of them. The stink in the air is strong. Rotwings form blurry clouds above the corpses, the insects buzzing with endless hunger. Tracine Kane pulls the white cloth over her mouth. Her nostrils are rimmed with salt dust. Commander Norwich said it would help prevent the smell from reaching her, and though it has diminished it considerably, still she smells the pickled, rotten stench of the dead. She lifts a finger and waves Lug toward her. The Trandoshan stops over. None of this seems to bother him. He's fond of telling her about life among his people, hunting and killing and reveling in death. He's not like that, not like the other reptilians, but it was still part of his childhood.
You want the shot set up, boss?
Right here, she says, holding the cloth over her face. Get that collapsed wall in the frame.
It has a dynamic shape, the tower broken, the wall shattered in just the right spot, and one body slumped over it. Lug grunts a command to the camdroid. It's an upgraded model, ruggedized and battle-hardy. The little floating droid with one telescoping eye hums along, pulsing flashes as it takes a series of still shots to frame out the hologram. It burbles and bleeps.
I'll get Norwich, Lug says.
No,
Tracine says, shaking her head.
Go get someone more common. We need to sell this to the common citizen, and that means putting the common citizen on cam. Get me a soldier, a private, a trencher.
As the big reptilian grunts and starts to walk off, she catches him by the arm.
How's my hair?
I don't know. It's hairy.
I'm going for battle-frizzled, but still well-kept, you know? In order to the chaos. A well-designed non-design.
Sure.
She rolls her eyes.
Thanks, Lug.
You got it, Trace.
He winks one of his eyes, an unnerving gesture, as a nictitating membrane slides sideways over the eyeball. It's meant to be playful, but it only comes across as monstrous. He saunters off. Things have changed for her in the last months. She's gone from the cushy platform of safe worlds and out into the galaxy. The war between the Republic and the Empire has gone hot. The New Republic keeps pushing the Empire back, and the Empire grows more and more desperate, like a cornered feral. Plus, the Holonet's mandate has changed. With the Imperial controls on what can be broadcast broken, the network is free to show the real story. Free to get into the middle of the fight and reveal the truth. Tracine said she needed to be on the front lines. So, by all the gods of all the stars, they put her on the front lines. Now it's her and Lug out here in the thicket of war. Nag Abdur in the Outer Rim. Home to the native Abdurians, plus the transplanted Keldar and Artiodak refugees, has seen a brutal pushback by the Empire. That most likely because the bedrock of Nag Abdur is flecked with cerium, an ore essential to the making of Durasteel. The Empire has strip-mined this world down to its nub, and still it keeps finding ore. As such, they're not keen to give it up. So they've bitten down hard and won't unclench.
Norwich said he suspects that the forces here aren't really under anyone's command, beyond what exists in the Ubdor system, meaning they're cut off from the Empire proper, making this yet another rogue Imperial remnant hunkering down, taking control, and either waiting for backup or carving out their own mad little fiefdoms. As such, the Imperials here have grown more and more brazen, driven, it seems, by desperation and fear. The massacre here in Binjai Tin is just one such example. They came in, swept through like unholy fire, killing everything in their path. That is unlike the Empire. The Empire has always been known to keep its populace in check, punish 10% to keep the 90 in line. This is not that. This is a whole other level, murderous and foul. Right now, she knows that only 10 clicks away, over the tussock and past the sedge, the Imperials have dug in. They've excavated trenches. They've got walkers, ties, a new garrison. A fight is coming. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon. And Tracine will be along for the ride. Her and Lug filming it all so the galaxy can see the valiant Republic against the venomous Empire. Speaking of her Trandoshan cam operator, Lug returns, hauling a new Republic soldier by the arm. It's some young, wide-eyed Capoan. His face pelt hangs bound up in a series of braids, helmet askew and pushing forward his eye stalks. He looks lost, shell-shocked even.
"What's your name?"
she asks. He blinks at the camera, then at Lug, then at her. The Capoan has the look of a lost child. She pats his arm.
"It's okay. We're not on cam yet. Can you tell me your name?"
He says,
"Roith Kadur, private in the NR."
His voice is a tremulous growl. He's not comfortable, but he'll have to do. The rest of the soldiers are counting the dead, setting up triage, building a camp. More women and men of the Republic keep trickling in, and will over the next several hours, given the long line of them outside the city's shield gate. Without warning, she holds up 3 fingers, then counts down. Lug wraps a knuckle against the cam droid, and its eye lens goes from red to green.
"And we're on," she says.
The soldier looks flummoxed, but then he nods.
"Tell me about yesterday, Private Kadur,"
she says.
Yesterday?
He blinks.
"Right. We encountered Imperial forces on the Govnir Ridge. It's like a plate shift where the ground bulges, and these tall crystals grow alongside it. And the Imperials were waiting for us. They came out of nowhere. It was intense. My squad leader, Hachinka, she got it in the neck. A blaster shot hit her, and the spray caught me on the face. And..."
He has to take a second. She lets him. It's good drama. The cam droid has a high enough resolution, too, that it'll capture and confirm what Kadur said. In his face, she sees the flecks of dry blood that belonged to his leader.
"We got her out of there, and she's still holding on. We lost a lot of good men and women, but we did it. We took the ridge."
She holds up a finger, and as the cam droid pivots toward her, she instructs it,
"Mark it. Run segment Govnir Ridge footage."
She already edited together a package of clips from last night. The cam droid will auto-splice it into this interview and send when they uplink to the HoloNet servers. Kadur seems confused as to what's happening, but she just smiles as reassuringly as she can. Tracine gives the droid a second as it runs through a catalog of beeps, then continues.
"Private Kadur, can you tell me where we are and what you believe happened here?"
His tongue licks his lips. It makes a raspy sound. And he says,
"This is an Ubdorian city. A merchant city. Binjai Tin, a mostly Abdorian population. The Empire. They came in here, and...
His voice cracks.
They slaughtered everybody. These people weren't soldiers. They were already under the boot, you know? Weren't allowed to carry blasters. Had to give a percentage of all earnings to the Empire. And what did it get them? This... a massacre.
The Capoan soldier flares his many nostrils. Tracine sees that he's at the edge of breaking. It's not his fault. She decides this is good enough. The footage will speak for itself. And anything else he has to say won't come close to the impact in the way he said that last word. Massacre. She tells him he can go, and thanks him. As he starts to walk away, Lug steps in front of the Capoan and gives him an awkward hug. The Trandoshan isn't good at affection, really. The hug is stiff and uncomfortable, and has all the warmth of a protocol droid romancing a tree stump. But she supposes it's the thought that counts. Then Lug hands the man a small token. A tooth broken off a Zlag fiend, which, she understands, is some kind of many-mouthed, dagger-fanged hell predator. Lug killed one when he was a boy, still hunting for his pack. He kept the teeth, of which there were many. Lug says to Kadur, as he says to all the soldiers with whom they speak,
"It's good luck. Take it. I tied it to a length of gut cord so you can wear it around your neck or wrist, or... just take it."
Kadur nods, then clasps Lug's hand before walking off.
"You're nice the way you do that,"
she says, a wry smile on her face. Lug shrugs and offers a growl hiss.
"Yes, they have it hard enough."
He almost looks sheepish about it. She laughs.
"All right. We need to get Nutblink on the highest point."
She gestures toward a guild tower. It's half-collapsed, but even broken, it's still pretty tall.
"Get the beam comm set up there."
"That's high."
"And you can climb."
Another disappointed hiss.
"Fine, fine, yeah, yeah."
He turns, starts walking. No spring in his step, of course, because Lug has two speeds, slow and slower. And she turns to look back at the gathering soldiers coming into the city square, setting up tents and generators. A gonk droid meanders about. Two soldiers splice a pair of cables together with a shower of blue electricity. Then, their eyes turn heavenward. Panic registers on their faces. Before she can turn, Tracine hears the sudden sound. TIE fighters, twin engines shrieking. She turns to look, and sure enough, a dozen of them framed against the purple sky. Coming in, and coming in fast. Tracine expects the obvious. Lasers cutting across the city, digging furrows in the cobble rock, tearing through soldiers, and maybe even her if she's not lucky. But no lasers. And yet the TIEs keep coming. She turns, screams for everyone to get back. They're setting up weapons and turrets, but it won't matter. Tracine grabs the cam droid and tucks it under her arm, running like hell toward Lug, yelling for him to run, too. Now! Fast! Go, go, go! The first TIE fighter hits the ground about 150 meters away. It plows into the wall surrounding the Binjai Tin City Square. And a massive fireball belches into the air. Stone and scrap rain down around her, and the ground shakes like it's throttled by a quake. It's the first, but it's not the last. The Imperial starfighters punch into the city, one after the next. Suiciders. The ground shakes so hard, she loses her footing. The cam droid tumbles away, its lens cracking. She hears screams and sees the space above smear behind a gauzy haze of superheated air. And then she closes her eyes, her ears ringing. It keeps going until it goes no more.
In the darkness behind her eyes, all she can do is think,
how desperate they must be to send these pilots on a suicide mission.
Because that's what this is. TIE fighters flung to the surface? Each a weapon unto itself?
Those bastards!
She tastes dirt and blood. Tracine has no idea how many TIE fighters hit or how long it took.
With a groan, she lifts herself up on wobbly arms.
Where the soldiers were entering the square is now a TIE interceptor, smashed into the ground, fire crackling and circuits popping. Bodies lie around. Others are alive, running for cover, weeping or mobilizing in case it means incoming troops. She sees Kadur not far away, standing in the middle of it all, dizzy and bewildered.
One of his arms is missing. Sheared off, it seems, from a piece of fighter debris stuck in the ground nearby. He waves at her. Such a strange gesture.
But in her short time out here, she knows that trauma will do that to you. It'll leave you spinning like a top. In that waving hand of Kadur's is a fang, dangling on a leathery cord.
Lug!
She turns toward her cam operator.
No! No!
Where he stood is a wing panel from one of the TIEs, bent up and smashed into the ground.
Tracine cries out and runs toward it.
If anyone can survive something like that, it'll be Lug. Trandoshans are built like steel rebar, swaddled in scale armor. She once watched him headbutt a jukebox in half because it wouldn't play his song. Didn't make a mark on him.
But there, she sees an arm. His arm, splayed out across the broken stone. She sees his face, too. Lug's head half crushed underneath the metal. Tracine hurries over on her hands and knees, calling his name. That name dissolving on her lips into a blubbering gush. His eyes are open, but empty. Blood runs from his mouth. He's gone.
She weeps for a time. How long, she doesn't know. Long enough that night starts to creep in, like a thief. Someone comes over, checks on her, and she shoos them away with a swipe of her nails. Eventually, she stands and feels the cold reality settle into her veins. Then, she does what she does best. She goes, picks up the cam droid, hits it a few times until it's working, then she brings it back to Lug's body. She crouches down, turns on the cam, and speaks into it, trying very hard not to cry.
This is Tracine Kane, Holonet news reporter, embedded with the New Republic 31st. And I'd like to tell you about a friend of mine. A friend the Empire just stole from me.
Chapter 24. Ashmead's lock goes dead. All his cams, all his connections, they go dark in perfect simultaneity. The feed is gone. The prison is liberated. Admiral Rax smiles. It is time.
Your ribs,
Jazz tells Nora.
They're broken.
Nora struggles to breathe.
Am I going to be all right?
Eventually. Doesn't feel like they puncture the lung, though I'm betting it feels that way to you.
Jazz manifests a rare smile.
I've been there, Vexley. More times than I can count. You'll make it through.
All around them, pocket lights spear through the darkness of the now derelict Ashmead's lock. One by one, her crew rescues the prisoners from their docks. It's literally dozens, maybe even 100 or more. Many of them are dressed in the uniforms of the Rebel Alliance. Officers and pilots and doctors from the days before the second Death Star fell. Some even before the first one blew.
thanks to the farm boy from Tatooine. Bodies shuffle past, weak and confused. They all get the same instructions. Head outside and wait. Oh, and don't stray, because who knows what waits out there in the dread Kashyyyk forest. Nora grunts, winces, and tries to stand.
Sit down, Jazz says.
You're not a doctor. I want to help.
You can help by sitting down. Would you stay seated?
In the half-darkness, she sees Jazz's shoulders shrug.
No.
And neither will I. So help me up already. The bounty hunter does as asked. All around, the shadows of droid carcasses surround them. Once the power cut out, they all slumped and fell like Okari junk puppets with their dancing wires cut. Clatter and collapse.
We find Sinjir and Jom yet? Nora asks. Jom's outside, helping keep people together. Sinjir, we haven't...
From somewhere in the darkness, an all-too-familiar voice reaches their ears. The voice is hoarse but clear.
Ugh! Everything tastes like licking a blasted battery. Someone, please, come get me.
Sinjir. Jazz retreats into the darkness, then returns with the ex-Imperial. In the glow of Jazz's pocket light, Sinjir looks like he just woke up from a week-long bender. Hair a muss, the whites of his eyes red, the skin around gone bruised dark. He is licking his lips and making a wrung wash rag face. He nods.
Nora, been a while. You end up in one of those pods?
Yes. Well, almost.
Not restful at all. Would not recommend.
He leans in between both Jazz and Nora, and in a low voice asks,
Either of you fine, upstanding New Republic citizens happen to bring a jorum of ski with you? A nip of kurva? I'm feeling a bit dry over here.
Anyone ever tell you you have a drinking problem?
Jazz asks.
My only problem is I'm not drinking.
She shakes her head.
Go help Temin and Solo get more of the prisoners free. I'll go with you.
Jazz turns to her.
Nora, you take it easy.
I'll go help the prisoners outside. Make sure they stay close.
Jazz starts to protest, but she cuts her off.
I need to stay busy. Need to keep focused.
The way her mind was going in that dock, it feels like she's on stable ground, but too close to a rain-slick edge. It wouldn't take much to tumble down again into the darkness of those terrible thoughts.
Okay?
Jazz sighs and nods. Nora grabs the light off her belt and makes her way outside. Out there, the dead forest is filled with life. Prisoners. Rebels. A Rodian in a flight suit stands staring off at nothing. A woman ties the sleeves of a cold weather coat around her middle. A Sullustan in blue Dantooinian robes leans for support against a pudgy old Corellian in a tattered Rebel Army jumpsuit. Nora limps along, shaking hands and clasping arms, offering words of wheezy encouragement, all the while trying not to cough, because coughing just feels like she's being punched with pistoning fists. She tries to share the good news with them that they're free, that they can go home soon, that the Rebel Alliance has become the New Republic.
Is he out here?
Solo comes out of the prison ship with the fury of a storm. He steps into the middle of the crowd, not far from Nora.
Yeah, hi,
he says to those gathered.
I'm looking for a big guy, hairy as anything. Wookie, name a Chewbacca.
Desperation shines on his face like a beacon. He spies Nora.
Nora, where is he? He's not in there.
Han, I'm sorry.
Don't say sorry. Just find him.
The panic on his face is clear, and she feels it too. Rescuing all these prisoners is a victory for the New Republic, but it's an accidental one. For Solo, the only thing that matters is paying what he owes, and that means finding his friend. Just then, A gurgling roar cuts the air. Solo spins around. There, coming out of the ship, alongside her son, is the massive walking fur beast, the Wookiee Chewbacca. Chewie! Solo calls, and laughs as he breaks into a run. The Wookiee looks bedraggled and beaten down, but that doesn't diminish Chewbacca's enthusiasm. The Wookiee tilts his head back and ululates a loud, joyful growl, then wraps his impossible arms around the smuggler. Solo looks like a child snatched up by an eager parent. For a moment, his whole body lifts up off the ground, his legs kicking as the Wookiee purrs and barks.
I messed up, pal.
Solo gasps as the Wookiee sets him back down. The Wookiee yips and barks.
No. I gotta own this one, big guy. I should have been there with you. But we'll make it right. I promise.
Then a moment as the Wookiee looks around. His body goes slack like he's taking it all in. Everyone goes silent. The Falcon's co-pilot utters a low growl. Solo nods.
Yeah. You're home, Chewie.
The Wookiee stands there, stock still and dead silent as he stares up at the trees, as if he's just realizing where he is. He makes no movement and utters no sound, as if nothing could convey what he's really feeling. Everyone waits to see what he'll do, but Chewbacca does nothing. More Wookiees emerge behind Temin.
Found another chamber of prisoners in the back. I think they're with you, Solo.
Thanks, kid. Thanks.
Those Wookiees join with Chewie, and together they stand with one another, staring up into the darkness of their damaged world. Nora watches it all. The tears that warm the corners of her eyes are ones she tells herself belong to the pain in her side, and not the one in her heart. She steps forward, intending to go to her son, hug him, ask him about Bones. But then, behind her, someone says her name.
Nora? Is that you?
Her knees go weak. She almost falls. Temin rushes to her, helps her before she falls. That voice. She turns to see if it really could be him. It couldn't be. After all this time, Brenton, she says. He's standing right there. Surely just a phantom. He's thinner, older, his skin pallid and his eyes bloodshot. But it's still him. Tenon's voice is small at first when he says, Dad? Which means Temin sees him too. He's not a phantom at all. Brenton is real. Her husband is alive, and he's standing right there.
Chapter 25. On the bridge of Home One, the Mon Calamari cheer. Out there in the expanse of space, the wreckage of ships floats above Kuat. Imperial ships, mostly, though the Republic lost some of its own over the last several weeks. The bombing campaign against the shipyards and supply bases of Kuat is complete. The sector governor, Moff Paulus Maxim, and the guild head of the Kuat drive yards have surrendered. The scopes are clear, with no further intrusions expected by the Empire. It has been a long, protracted fight, and now it's over.
Congratulations, Admiral,
Leia says to Akbar. She is not physically present, but she stands there as a holographic communication, an avatar summoned by the Mon Calamari.
You and Commodore Argate have won the day for the New Republic.
With a plucky smile, she adds,
Again.
Akbar, though, is not one to cheer. Leia knows that he shares in the optimism of his fellow officers, nodding and smiling along. He wouldn't dare darken their light with the shadow of cynicism and worry. Just the same, he remains steadfast in reminding everyone that every battle has its costs. The battle for Kuat drive yards is no different. Next to Leia, the other hologram, this one of Commodore Kirsta Agate,
nods and smiles stiffly.
I'm glad we accomplished something today. Taking weapons out of the Empire's hands was a worthy goal, and one I'm glad the Senate supported.
Battles with the Senate, Leia thinks. She knows that this is the nature of democracy, and she welcomes that struggle. Just the same, this will be a chaotic time. And though it is the soldiers who experience the true trauma, the galaxy's citizens are war-weary. Theirs is a deeper, more sustained trauma, a fear and suspicion embedded like a splinter under the skin. This time with the Senate will be a tumult of indecision. They're understandably gun-shy. And, Leia knows, this is why Kashyyyk remains enslaved. Through the viewscreen, the front hatchet end of the Starhawk battleship cleaves its way through the open space above Kuat. A considerable ship, the Starhawk, and one that belongs exclusively to the New Republic forces. Getting the vote from the Senate to approve the scrapping of Imperial craft in order to build new ships, droids, and weapons was its own battle that may have been harder fought than the orbit-to-ground battle here at Kuat. A not inconsiderable number of the current senators still remember when Palpatine formed the Empire out of the ashes of a republic they didn't even know was burning. He quickly commissioned ships, too, to serve his new military order. Their fear is born of good reason. It is a credit to Mon Mothma that she was able to marshal the votes, despite her own doubts about creating new weapons of war. Kirsta Augate, for her part, has mitigated her accomplishment today with a heavy brow. It's one of the reasons both Leia and Ackbar like her so much. Augate understands that the costs of war are heavy even in victory. The balance on that bill is not easily paid off, and it shows in the suffering of the soldiers decades after fighting ends. It manifests as political fear. It is demonstrated by criminals, terrorists, and other sympathizers. Only peace, protracted peace, true peace, balances those books. Just the same, Leia wants both the Admiral and the Commodore to feel proud.
The shipyards at Kuat were a vital resource for the Galactic Empire, and their loss will be keenly felt,
Leia says.
We have hamstrung the production of new fighters and capital ships. Further, we can turn these resources around and use them as our own.
Augate smirks.
I know all this, Princess Leia, but I appreciate what you're trying to do.
Take the victory and enjoy it, Commodore. You too, Admiral.
Ackbar harumphs.
I will, but I want to keep my eye on what matters most. Ending this conflict. Nobody wins a war, Leia. Best we can do is find a way to stop fighting.
In that, Admiral, we are agreed.
Just then, a new communique incoming. Ackbar nods to Comm Officer Toktar, and she puts the visual through. Another hologram appears. Chancellor Mon Mothma.
Chancellor!
Ackbar says, giving a deferential nod.
I did not expect to hear from you so soon. Is today not the Senate budgetary proceeding?
It is.
Even in hologram, the Chancellor looks weary. This is taking a lot out of her. It's taking a lot out of them all. Leia notices a moment when Mon Mothma's gaze flicks toward her. What is that there? What forms the backbone of that hesitation? Suspicion? Irritation? As fast as it came, it's gone again, and Leia wonders if she's just imagining things. Mon Mothma, anxious, says,
There is another matter, something pressing. We have received a communication request from the Operator.
The Operator? The shadowy operative from deep within the Empire, who has periodically appeared in order to direct the New Republic to Imperial vulnerabilities. Leia has never properly trusted that source. After all, the destruction of the second Death Star was born of a ruse concocted by Palpatine, one that perhaps should have been more easily seen. This, though, feels different. It has gone on too long. The Operator's intel has afforded them a dozen victories already. and it's hard to imagine exactly how this could be a deception. It would have to be a very long confidence game. And even then, to what end? Why would the Empire hobble itself? They have all come, however, reluctantly, to trust the source. But it's been some time since the Operator has revealed himself. Since Akiva, as a matter of fact. Mumblings inside the New Republic have pondered at the fate of that mysterious agent. Was he caught? Killed? Did he flee? Who was he, after all of that?
Has the Operator set a time for this communication?
Akbar asks.
No, actually,
the Chancellor answers.
So be it.
To his comm officer, he says,
Tokhtar, please, if you will, open a channel. Old Alliance frequency, Zeta Zeta 9.
A new holographic image shimmers into view. And it is not the Operator.
Grand Admiral Akbar,
says the vision of Ray Sloan. On her end, Leia feels everything clench up. The Operator is gone. The Empire has surely discovered the traitor. The appearance of Sloan, one of the heads of the Imperial Remnants, the strongest remnant, if their intel is accurate, only confirms it.
Grand Admiral is an Imperial ranking,
the Mon Cala says.
I, like you once did, identify as Fleet Admiral. But you seem to have taken the title Grand Admiral for yourself.
Sloan stiffens and shrugs.
No one above to promote me, I'm afraid, Admiral. In this new order, one must take what one deserves. Why do you darken our door today?
Mon Mothma asks.
I come to reveal myself. Reveal yourself? I can't say I understand. I am the Operator.
No,
Leia thinks.
It couldn't be.
This woman has been her counterpart in a way. The two of them operating as a voice speaking to the wider galaxy. Each trying to secure fresh footing among the citizens. Each speaking for her people. Leia for the resurgent Republic, Sloan for the dwindling Empire. And so, it seems impossible to believe. The others don't believe it either. Augate says,
That curtain is all too thin, Admiral Sloan. It's easy to see the lie.
I'm sorry. Who are you again?
Sloan asks.
Commodore Augate.
Ah, yes. The one who led the charge on Kuat. A convincing victory and deserving of respectful congratulations, Commodore.
Augate isn't having any of it.
You were on Akiva. You were part of that secret cabal. And the Operator turned us onto it and against it. That put your life in danger. You cannot be the Operator. It makes no sense.
I gave you targets,
Sloan says,
in order to strengthen my position within the Empire. The events on Akiva allowed me to seize control, relatively speaking. All the targets you will find stood in opposition to my ascent.
Leia mentally tallies their victories performed in service to the Operator. She wonders, could Sloan be right? Leia wondered what exactly the Empire would have to gain by sacrificing parts of itself. And there, so clear they should have seen it, was the answer. The elimination of competition.
Why tell us any of this?
Leia challenges.
More likely you discovered the identity of the Operator and had him or her executed. Ah, Leia. So we meet. Or as close to it as we can muster. It is an honor to meet you. Genuinely. You have done so much. Amazing how so much of the galaxy has changed based on the actions of one Alderaanian princess. I am only as good as those who surround me,
Leia says.
Now answer the accusation. You killed the Operator and are lying to us. No. I'm using the Operator's channel because we are losing this war, princess. Your victory at Kuat demonstrates that neatly. And I'm tired of losing. I'm tired of all this, to be frank. It is time to negotiate. Surrender?
The Chancellor asks.
Don't be hasty,
Sloan chides.
I offer you surrender, and the Empire takes my head. They'd probably send it to you packed into the nose cone of a thermoclastic missile. It is time for peace talks.
Akbar's chin tendrils curl inward upon themselves. He must be feeling what Leia is. Her own instincts light up like an alarm. Something's off kilter here. Sloane is playing with them. And yet, the loss of Kuat is significant. A major wound. The Empire would certainly want to staunch the bleeding. But what should the New Republic do in response? Allow them time to tend to their injuries? An act of compassion against an Empire that has demonstrated none? Or press the advantage, grinding them into the dirt, leading to more lives lost, more instability, more madness across the galaxy? Giving them a place in the future of the galaxy allows for some measure of constancy and peace. And here, Akbar's words haunt her.
Nobody wins a war. Best we could do is find a way to stop fighting.
This could be that. It could be an opportunity. Or it could be a grievous mistake.
We will need to speak about this and then put it to the Senate,
Mon Mothma says.
I understand. Palpatine did away with the Senate because it cooled the engine's progress, but his way has not proven effective. He is gone, and you remain. So here we are. Talk to your people. I would suggest having the peace talks on your world with minimal guard. I am offering that as a concession of trust. So noted, Admiral Sloane. Thank you. Good day. And congratulations again to you all. I am a warrior before I am anything else, and what you have accomplished is impressive. I hope to hear from you in time. Use this channel, and I will respond.
And with that, her hologram blinks out. It leaves behind a considerable vacuum. The four of them are silent. The others are surely like Leia in that they are bewildered and bemused by what just transpired. Could this be real? And if it is, then what?
I will convene an emergency session of the Senate,
the Chancellor says.
Let's hope this is something. It may be a way forward to peace. May the Force be with you.
When the Chancellor is gone, Leia says to Augate and Akbar,
may the Force be with us all. I fear we are going to need it.
Chapter 26. The quiet of Kashyyyk is unsettling. Nothing is here. No life. No insects buzzing. No rustle of underbrush as creatures pick through sticks and leaves. In contrast, the jungles of Akiva are alive. Too alive. Nora remembers how the canyons of Akkar were home to hooting Ateles and squawking clever birds and hissing bladder bugs. The cacophony of the rainforest was almost deafening, louder at night than it was in the day. This is not that. It's a dead channel, a null frequency. At least here, in this small section of the planet, the Empire has killed everything. And Nora sits, staring off into the silence, wishing for a moment that she had a little jaquad leaf chew. Muddle the black leaves and pink petals of the jaquad flower, then chew it to make yourself awake, alive, aware. An Akivan tradition. It would make her ribs feel better. It would make everything feel better. Right now, not far behind her, the rest of her crew is helping bring the rest of the captives out of the prison ship, preparing their egress from the planet's surface. Brenton, her husband, is with Temen. Last she left them, they were both on the halo looking over the pieces of Bones who had been ultimately torn limb from limb. The droid is still functioning, but can't seem to speak. He can only broadcast garbled mechanical static blasts. She hears someone coming up behind her.
A glance over her shoulder reveals Han Solo.
Hey,
he says.
You did it. You found him.
We did it. You were right. I couldn't have done it without your help.
You going soft on me?
She asks.
No, but I'm in a good mood. Just go with it.
He comes up alongside and looks out with her. He's got that, aw, shucks, sheepishness about him suddenly. Hands in pockets. Wanting to say something, but not really able to say it out loud.
So, you know, thanks.
Nora doesn't have much to say in return, and talking only makes her two shattered ribs, now swaddled in a hasty wrapping of bonding tape, courtesy of the oh-so-compassionate Jazamari, feel like they're stabbing her. So instead, she just nods and keeps on staring out.
That really your husband back there?
It is.
Then we both have cause to celebrate.
Absolutely.
But he must detect the tremor in her voice.
Why aren't you with him? You're out here instead.
I wanted him to have time with my son.
Sure, sure. Nothing more to it than that, huh?
He's poking around, feeling her out.
Nothing on your mind?
I failed Brenton. I found him here only by accident. It's been so long. Everything has changed. I've changed. Temin has changed. The whole galaxy has changed. But Brenton hasn't.
No, she lies.
Nothing.
She feels like a failure. A traitor. And here, her mind flits to Wedge. And that only deepens her sense of treachery.
It's not that she doesn't love Brenton. She does. And will.
He is her husband, and the father of her child. And she can't face him. Not easily. Not now.
I got a kid on the way,
Solo says suddenly.
Yes, I suspected.
He kicks at a stick.
I should be there. I should be there now. For Leia. For that kid. I got this thing hanging over me. This thing I gotta do. I'll never be all the way there, long as it isn't done. I'll never be me. I can't be a good father until...
He curls his hand and presses a knuckle into the tree. Not a punch, but hard enough that the bones in his fingers crack and pop.
I'm just saying, sometimes you have to do what you have to do.
You're not leaving, are you?
Am I that transparent?
As clear and as tough as a sheet of blast glass.
You take the Falcon. It's the fastest ship in the galaxy, and we got just shy of 100 prisoners who need medical attention. It'll be a tight fit, a real cattle car, but you'll manage. Plus, some of those prisoners are staying here with me and Chewie.
The refugees?
Yeah, and a couple other poor undesirables who got swept up by that Star Destroyer. See what kind of damage we can do.
Nora stares off into the dead forest.
Looks like the Empire already did its damage.
It isn't all like this. Right now we're at the edge of the Shadowlands. Closer to the cities, that's where you find the camps, the mines, the labs. That's where you find the Empire.
You're going to liberate it all by yourself?
Or die trying.
Leia and your child? How will they feel about that?
He scratches at the back of his head.
I don't know. They'll hate me, probably. But maybe in time they'll get it. They'll see I had to do this.
Better come back alive, then.
Guess I'd better.
Nora grimaces as she reaches out with her hand.
Solo takes it. Shakes it. It's been an honor,
she says.
Go be with your family. Take them home, Nora Wixley.
Thanks, Solo. Good luck here.
Luck has saved my tail before. Let's hope that trend holds.
Not long after, Nora gathers the whole crew. Everyone except Temin. He's with Brenton still. As it should be.
and she doesn't want to give him this choice. The darkness here on Kashyyyk is lightning now. A gray, gauzy light from the sun in this system. Fingers of that light shine through the trees and the mist, and Nora steps into a beam of it and tells them all what's happening. She explains that Solo is staying behind.
A fool's crusade,
Sinjir mutters, then louder.
An idiot's parade!
I think some of you should stay with him,
Nora says.
I'll stay,
Jazz says with zero hesitation.
What?
Jom asks.
What?
Sinjir echoes. Jazz shrugs.
We took out Gedi, but we didn't free any of Slusson Kanker's slaves. That didn't sit right with me. We can do differently here.
This is a whole fragging planet,
Jom says.
We're gonna free it? Ourselves? We're good, Amari, but we're not that good.
Besides, Sinjir says, I don't think there'll be a payout for this.
I can usually wring a few credits out of any situation. And maybe this payout isn't about money. We helped free Akiva. That felt good. Sinjir, how did it feel almost sticking a sharpened antenna into Aran's ear?
Nora watches. The ex-Imperial starts to answer, but instead just looks down at his feet.
You shouldn't feel bad about it,
Jazz says.
You did a bad thing because you had to. Because sometimes you have to do bad in service of good. But once, just once, I want to do something really good. Good even though it's stupid. Good because it's right.
Sinjir makes a faux gagging sound.
Wah! Oh, yuck, Jazz. No.
Sinjir? Yes.
Fine,
he says, rolling his eyes.
Blah, blah, blah. I crave purpose and recompense for my crimes and etc., etc. I'll stay, too. Besides, this is an Imperial-governed planet. Maybe news of my treachery has not yet reached these forested coasts, and I can press that advantage.
You've all gone batty,
Jom says. But then he sighs and throws up his hands.
But I've already gone off the map on this one. Might as well stick around a little while longer. See what kind of damage we can do here to the Imperial war machine. Soldier is as a soldier does and all that.
Nora nods and smiles. It's what she hoped would happen.
How about you?
Jazz asks Nora. I'm taking my family and the captives, along with my injured self, home. But I'll be thinking about you, and I'll see if I can send help. Jazz nods and steps up to Nora.
Stay safe, Nora. Be good, Jazz. A little good, but not too good.
She says her goodbyes, too, with Sinjir and Jom. It hits her suddenly, the overwhelming feeling that she might not see these people again. Her darkest thought is also the loudest. Staying behind and trying to liberate Kashyyyk is a suicide mission. Chapter 27. Everything's so dizzy, and it's hard to cut through the pain in her side and see her way through to what has happened. But one shining moment is bright enough to manage. Nora's sitting there in the pilot's seat of the Falcon, feeling like a stranger in someone else's house. Her son is next to her, acting as co-pilot. And then, Brenton comes up behind them. He kisses the top of his son's head. He kisses Nora's cheek. He leans on them both. One hand on her shoulder, another on Temin's shoulder. And as Nora brings the Falcon out of hyperspace, Chandrila rushing into view, he laughs a little.
It's amazing, he says.
Amazing? She asks a little cheekily.
Things have changed. I hate that I missed it. But look at the two of you.
Nora, you're a pilot. Temin, you are too. The Rebel Alliance won, and I'm not happy I missed all that. but I'm happy to see what you both became. His voice shakes when he says, I feel like I woke up from sleep, and the galaxy moved on without me.
We didn't move on,
Tevin says. Nora rubs the top of her husband's hand. That hand is trembling just so.
Tim's right. You were missing from us. But now we're a family again. And nothing can change that,
she says, convincing even herself.
Things will feel weird for a while, but that's okay. We'll get past it. For now, though, can you check on everyone back there? Let them know we'll soon be clear to land?
I will, he says, and then adds, I love you guys.
We love you too,
Tevin says. As Brenton heads back, Nora and her son exchange looks. She remarks to herself just how happy the boy looks. In fact, she can't remember the last time she's seen that look on his face.
He's beaming, bright as the sun. Let's go home,
Tevin says. Nora transmits clearance codes to Chandrila Tower Control. The Falcon descends. The ship is crammed full of people. Tevin works his way through the back of the craft, talking to them all as he passes.
You're free from the Empire,
he tells an Ithorian woman pressed into the back corner. She murmurs gratitude at him.
We're landing now,
he says to a young Rhodian, whose face is marred with a meshwork of scars.
It's gonna be okay,
he assures a barrel-bellied man in Rebel Army raiment. At the back of the ship, through the throng of bodies, Tevin finds his father doing the same thing, assuring the others, holding their hands, embracing them. Some weep, some laugh. Excitement is present like a static charge in the air.
Dad,
Tevin says. Son, Brenton says.
Master Timmons' father,
Mr. Bones says, suddenly interjecting himself between the two. He reaches out with two claw arms and mashes father and son together. Their heads bonk.
This precious moment must be sealed by a hug. A loving yet violent entanglement of bodies, wherein one person grabs another with great force and squeezes, but not so hard that their eyes rupture from their
bones,
Tevin says sharply.
Shh!
Roger, roger!
Brenton stares on with goggling eyes. The Obi-Wan? You repaired him already?
Yep.
Just with the supplies from the Falcon? Tevin hears some awe in his father's voice.
Yeah.
You take after me. Tevin grins big.
Yeah.
A crowd is gathered on the landing platform as the Millennium Falcon swoops in low, easing downward. News traveled fast and wide. Not only is Han Solo's ship returning, but it's bringing with it a bevy of prisoners, many of whom haven't been seen since the earliest days of the Rebel Alliance. Some family members have gathered, as have others from that era, who are eager to see if they can welcome the return of friends, comrades, and loved ones. Those gathered cheer and whoop. Two of those gathered are about to be disappointed. They will arguably be the only two truly disappointed, and each will feel this disappointment keenly and starkly in contrast with what must be an otherwise triumphant, happy-making day. Those two are Leia Organa and Wedge Antilles. Wedge stands there with flowers, nothing too big or ostentatious. The strange little woman at the Hana City greenhouse tried to get him to carry a bouquet as big as his chest and full of all the colors of the rainbow. But he said that wasn't Nora's style. Instead, he went with something understated, simple but elegant. 6 sundew flowers. Beautiful, yes, but they last. Firm stems and resilient petals. They don't wilt. They smell beautiful. And they're as golden to him as Nora is. Leia, for her part, has brought no gift but herself. She beams,
her cheeks flushed with excitement. The Falcon is returning, and with it, her husband must surely be returning too. This is a good day, she tells Wedge over the din of the crowd.
It sure is,
he answers. The Falcon eases down onto the platform, rocking on its landing gear. The plank descends, and through the hiss of steam come the freed captives. Dozens of them, each meeting guards as they come off. Guards who usher them through a receiving line where they meet Akbar and Mon Mothma. They aren't forced to dwell. They're directed to a series of transports lined up at the edge of the platform. Transports that will take them to the Senate Plaza, where the Chancellor has food and a medical tent, and officers waiting to perform interviews of those returning. The captives keep coming, offloading one after the other. Leia must know that Han and Chewie will be among the last off. Wedge knows this too about Nora. And then, Nora does step off the ship. Temin just ahead of her, and the clanking droid Bones just ahead of him. Temin is happy. Happier than Wedge has seen the kid. He's about to call to the boy. About to say, hey, Snap, over here. But then, he sees the man next to Nora. He doesn't know who the man is, but the man has his arm around Nora. He kisses her cheek. She kisses his lips. It clicks into place pretty quick, clicking like a thermal detonator set to blow. And blow it does, right inside Wedge's chest. The realization that Nora found her husband robs his lungs of air. He looks to Leia, and he sees her searching his face. And he watches the moment, too, when Nora and her husband are last off. And the Falcon closes up after nobody else gets off.
He didn't come home, Leia says.
I know, Wedge answers. I'm sorry.
He's still out there.
I'm sure Han is all right.
I'm sure he is too. I trust him.
But the way she says it, Wedge isn't so sure.
I have to talk to Nora, though. I have to find out what happened.
Maybe give her just a little time. It looks like she brought home someone special to her.
Leia smiles despite her certain disappointment.
It does at that.
Chapter 28.
With the Halo, Jazz got them out of what the Wookiees called the Black Forest, an area of the world that had long been dead. Dead for millennia, they said. A place poisoned by something real bad happening here. Something that left a darkness, like an imprint in wet concrete. At least that's how Solo translated it. Jom doesn't speak Shriwook, so that means relying on the smuggler as the go-between. Working with Solo on this has been interesting. Chewbacca the Wookiee is the man's co-pilot, his sidekick of a sort. At least that's how Jom had always heard it. The two were inseparable. But Solo was the pilot, and Chewie was the co-pilot, and so it would always be. But here on Kashyyyk, the roles are reversed. Chewie's in charge. He leads the way. And the real surprise is, Solo follows. He lets the Wookiee set the course. He offers insight, but it's deferential. And if anybody says boo to Chewie's ideas, Solo's first on the line to get snappy about it. Once Jazz got them out of the Black Forest, Chewie had the ship fly low to the ground along a White Rapids river that had carved a channel between massive trees. Solo said that he and Chewie had been collecting intel on Kashyyyk for years. Jom protested, said that by now the data was probably out of date, and the on-the-ground intel was more important. Solo bit back.
No kidding, Commando. But what we got is good. And unless you got better, I suggest you shut your mustache hole.
Sinjir chuckled and said,
Mustache hole. I'll have to write that one down.
Quiet, Sinjir,
Jom said. Jazz just snickered from the pilot's seat, which Jom admits now hurt him more than he expected. The river roared down over a tumble of broken trees, down into a dammed-up reservoir ringed by shattered trees. Chewie had Jazz bring the halo up over that waterfall and park it atop on a Rorschach branch, right where the branch met the tree. Jom didn't think the galaxy had trees big enough for the branches to support a whole ship, but he's happy to be proven wrong. Together, we all go out along the branch. There exists plenty of space to walk, though Vertigo still plucks at Jom's strings, and he can't help but wonder how long it would take to hit the ground if he fell. Solo goes on to explain Chewie's plan.
This is a big planet, and best anybody can tell, the Imperial occupation is dug in like a bloodworm.
Maybe dug in harder, given the shoddy state of affairs after the Death Star went boom.
But Chewie's got an idea.
Don't you, buddy? The Wookiee nods and growl barks a reply. The one-armed Wookiee, Greybok, gestures with his remaining hand in apparent agreement.
We can't free this planet by our lonesome,
Han says.
Much as we'd like to. We've been lucky in that regard before, but this time, no go.
Chewie grumbles.
That's right, Solo says. We need an army.
Jazz leans in.
I work lean. I don't work with armies.
Too bad, Solo says.
Give us a target. Find us the dragon's head and we'll cut it off and watch the planet fall.
Won't be that easy. Sure, the planet's under the governance of one man, Lozan Tolruk. But he's got 3 Star Destroyers up there. And intel says he's hidden away in an island fortress. He's a target, though. Because he's the one in charge of the inhibitor chips.
What? Jom asks.
Every Wookiee on this planet has a chip stuck in their heads. Keeps them docile. Anytime they act out, the chips fry them with pain until they fall back in line or die. We take out the chips, we give the Wookiees their minds back. But they'll still be locked away in settlements. We kill the control chips and liberate just one big settlement, and we have the army we need to free the rest. To do that, we need more information.
Sinjir cracks his knuckles and winks.
I can handle that part.
You still need to start somewhere,
Jom says.
There,
Solo says, pointing down past the massive dam and reservoir. Tucked between 2 fallen trees is a command installation, an Imperial cinder block plunked down into the rich, loamy soil. Jom grabs a pair of quad knocks and focuses in. As he does, Solo keeps talking.
The command station's going to have computers and officers, and that means intel. They can tell us where Tolruk's settlement is. They can point us to the most vulnerable settlement. But that means we gotta go in hot. We take the halo, fly in fast with cannons blazing.
Slow up,
Jom interrupts. He pulls the quad knocks away from his eyes and says,
I see 4 ground-to-sky turbo lasers down there. You fly the halo in, and she'll get blasted into cinders.
Give us that,
Jazz says, cursing at him. She spits on the ground.
You saying I can't handle my own ship? I'll stay clear of those lasers easy, Barel. You haven't seen half of what I can do.
Fine. Let's say you manage.
He lifts his chin in defiance.
They'll still see you coming a kilometer away. That gives them plenty of time to mount a proper defense or even escape. We can't see on the other side of that station. They might have a couple of chicken walkers or an escape shuttle waiting.
Oh, you have a better idea?
She challenges.
Slagging right I do. Send me down. On the ground. 2-prong approach. I take a couple of these hairballs.
Watch it!
Solo says.
Sorry. I take a couple of these noble warriors, and we sneak in and hit them hard. We shut down whatever defenses we can, and only then do the rest of you come blasting in with the halo.
I like it, Solo says. You can take out those turbo lasers?
That's the plan.
Jazz grabs his arm.
Can I talk to you for a second?
Sure thing, Amari.
She pulls him back toward the halo and shoves him behind one of the tilted turbines.
What do you think you're doing?
My part,
he answers.
Don't play the hero.
I'm not a hero. I'm a soldier. A workhorse.
A soldier who left his command for... Well, we know why.
Do we?
She scowls.
We do. You left for me.
Don't get so full of yourself.
You chased me like a puppy dog to Irudiru.
Hey,
he says, rebuffing her. He stabs his finger in the center of her chest.
I wanted to do my part and find Solo.
She grabs his finger and twists.
Great, you found him. Did you then run back to Chandrila with him in a bag?
She lets go, and he pulls away.
No. You stayed on, like that lost puppy.
You're a brat.
And you're a thug.
He shrugs.
I'm a thug who's here. I'm a thug who can fight. Don't question my motivations.
She stomps off.
Fine. Do what you want, Burrell.
Fun's over, I guess,
he calls after her. The commando lingers behind, fuming. She is a brat. What's worse, she's not wrong. He did follow her to Irudiru, because damn it, he likes her. And that makes him feel exactly like the lost puppy she thinks he is. Imagining her taking the halo and getting chewed apart by those turbo lasers. Ah, he shakes it off. Time to rejoin the others. Time to do the work. Time to fight. Part 5, Chapter 29. It has been a month. Nothing has changed. Everything has changed. Wedge Antilles crosses the white macadam of the spaceport, walking toward a fat-bellied shuttle at the far end. Ahead of him, the wind carries sachi blossoms, petals caught on the breeze, looking like canary moths flitting about the air. His leg is getting better. He no longer needs the cane. The limp is still there, haunting him like a spirit who refuses the exorcism from his bones. But slowly, surely, he's getting up to speed. Ahead, a Pantoran man with bristle-brushed mutton chops polishes the flat chrome plating on the shuttle's fore. As Wedge approaches, the man turns, then offers a hasty salute.